This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. When the surging Cedar River started to threaten Cedar Rapids on June 13, 2008, Gail Naughton thought her library and museum would be safe. After all, it was built above the floodplain. But as she and her staff scrambled to get the collections out, the river continued to rise. It was a devastating loss, but much of the art books and other rare items were saved. The flood did not kill the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. There are plans to move, expand, and elevate the library at a nearby spot in Czech Village. We'll hear today how the museum is moving forward. And also this hour, we'll find out what the Figge Art Museum in Davenport has been up to. Director Sean O'Hara says the facility is busier than ever, due in part to housing most of the collection of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. Its building, like the Czech Museum, was ruined in the flood of 2008. Talk of Iowa in 5 minutes following news. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Today, an Iowa museum update. First, the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library in Cedar Rapids. The rapidly surging Cedar River devastated the facility on June 13, 2008. I asked CEO Gail Naughton to describe her reaction on that fateful day when she realized that the museum was in peril and that not all of the collections could be saved.
When you have your whole operation, you know, essentially flooded and damaged and devastated, you've lost revenue, you've had collections in peril, and your operation taken out from under you, it really is quite a lot to deal with.
Did you ever think in June, what was it, June 16th, wasn't it? Or
the crest in Cedar Rapids was on the 13th.
Okay.
Friday the 13th.
Oh. Did you ever think that there would be a future for the museum and library after that?
I never doubted. I never doubted that we would come back from it. But one of the devastating things that happened after the flood, I went to Prague in September and to visit with all of our friends and colleagues over there and kind of give them an update and so forth. And I sat down with our great friend at the National Museum there, who we have a partnership with them. We've had many exhibits from there who've come over here. And she said, you know, Gail, we will never be able to send you an exhibit again to be inside that building. And that was another devastation. We quickly learned that we would not be able to insure our collections there. We wouldn't be able to have other exhibitions from other museums there. And so all of a sudden, your main facility cannot be what it was designed to be. And so that put us on a trek to find a way, you know, to either use that building to save it or, you know, to move on. Mm. And so it's been quite an 18 months to come around to the right plan, I think.
What was the reaction of your friends in Prague when they first found out? Were they following this in the media, or did you call them or what?
Well, we did have phone calls almost immediately. I talked to the ambassadors, both from the Czech and Slovak republics, the next day. They know what it's like to have a flood. Prague had a devastating flood in 2002, and some of their national museums were damaged. We were in touch with media over there within hours, it was an international story, and our kind of red roof, if you will, sticking out above the water, was shown all over the world. Yeah. So we were in touch with media over there. And when I was there in September then, I followed up with a number of them and did interviews on air and on radio and so forth.
Are there more connections with the Czech Republic or with Slovakia, or is it about 50-50 in this?
Well, in the Central America was settled more by the Czechs, and the Slovaks settled more on the East Coast. So when this museum was founded, it was Czechoslovakia, so it was a Czechoslovak museum. So when the change to a national museum happened, you really can't tell the story of the Czechs without the Slovaks and vice versa. And so it is a Czech and Slovak, but it is more of a challenge for us to stay connected to the Slovak constituencies.
How much was actually lost in the flood? I mean, if you look at your collections, you had various types of collections from phonograph records to art to manuscripts.
Library collection, artifact collection. In the artifact collection, we removed quite a bit prior to the flood, as the library collection. We had loaded up two semi-loads in the couple of days we had before, you know.
That was pretty amazing because Cedar Rapids, the flood came on so much faster than it did in Iowa City, where the University Museum of Art here had a fair amount of time, not all
well,
the time.
They did, but I think they had a harrowing time, too, getting things out. And we, even when we removed those things, we didn't really think we were going to have water in that museum. It was the predictions and the forecasts. Of course, we know now that they were flawed, but at that time, it's what we had to go by. We did them as precautions, but we did not expect that we would really have water. And if so, we thought maybe an inch or two. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as it turned out, we had 8 feet. And so the artifact collection, 80% of that is safe. And about 20% was damaged. Many of those things are being conserved and have been conserved. We'll have a few things that we will lose, but we will be able to replace them over time. The library collection, we removed a lot of material before the flood. Not all, though, and we do have some damaged materials that are also being treated. And we've had offers of help from the Slovak National Library, the Czech National Library, their museums, to help us replace things we've lost. And so there's been an outpouring of help and support.
Yeah, and who's helping you? Is the University of Iowa Library,
yes,
I'm sure, is helping? And
well, we, you know, this was a story within the story of the flood. Because the university shut down then when the flood was headed its way, the director of the of conservation, Nancy Kraft, at the libraries was marooned, if you will, in Cedar Rapids. And so she stepped up and met with us before we even got back in our building. While Iowa City was dealing with its crest, she was helping us with some of the very initial steps in getting back into the building and triaging what was damaged and knowing what to do.
Well, it's going to be what? We're coming up on 2 years in June. I mean, it has to be just terribly difficult past year and a half for you, but it sounds like I can see some hope
we are seeing light now.
Yeah.
We do see the plans, and we're going to be opening up a more permanent location in Czech Village on 16th Avenue, right in the center of Czech Village. Mm-hmm. We purchased a building, and we call it the Kosek Building. Many people remember it because it was kind of a favorite dime store in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and quite fondly remembered. And we have been renovating that building. We will have an exhibition there on the main floor. We'll have our administrative offices on the second floor and some more support space and a classroom down in the lower level. That will get us back to our neighborhood, where we really needed to be, and give us a place to operate from while we do the final work on bringing back the exhibition center and research library, the main operation of the museum.
Now, you call this the Kosek Building. Was this building damaged then in the flood?
Yes, it was, but it was gutted out like all of them were, and we took it over at that point and have redone it all. We've added an elevator, and, you know, we've doing some really major renovations. It's a lovely historic building. The exhibition is going to be called "Rising Above: The Story of a People and the Flood," and it, you know, as a national museum in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, people come there and they say, "Well, why is the National Museum in Iowa? Why is it in Cedar Rapids?" And we never had an exhibition. We never had a way to really tell that story, and so we took this opportunity to do that. It tells the story of kind of the Czechs in Cedar Rapids, Czech Village, the founding of the museum, and then incorporates the story of the flood, because in Cedar Rapids, it happened in those neighborhoods, just devastated. It's now forever a part of the history of these areas. And so this will be the place where you can bring your relatives from out of town if they want to understand what this kind of a disaster is. And Yeah. It's going to be a very interactive. Be able to share your own memories, share some your own family stories or whatever you'd like to do, and we hope that it'll be there a long time.
So this is not just a temporary. This building is not just a temporary place where you're going to be using it.
No, we hope that this will be a long-term addition. What we're really working on is a visitor experience that really just transcends walls. So you're not just going into one gallery and one static experience. We want to incorporate the story of Czech Village, getting you down on the avenue, having the story of the flood that devastated this area, and then the larger picture of the immigrant experience for Czechs and Slovaks, and that story of freedom and identity that is the fuel of the immigrant story. So we're putting pieces together here that will be a whole when we complete all this.
Are you of Czech or Slovak ancestry, Gail?
No. No, I'm not. I guess I've come to adopt the country, you know.
Yeah. How did you learn about it? Because obviously you're an authority now.
In the 90s, after the wall came down, my husband traveled to Prague, and he was actually thought he might do some teaching over there. The kind of thing that he teaches business and entrepreneurial kinds of things. And at that time, they really weren't ready yet. It was almost too soon. But in those travels, he ended up anyway establishing a restaurant in Prague, the first Iowa corporation incorporated in the Czech Republic. And that restaurant is still there today, although we're not involved.
What's it called?
It's called Buffalo Bill's Tex-Mex Bar and Grill. We brought the margarita to Prague.
Wonderful.
It was really very successful. There were so many expats in those days who were living there, and there was just a burgeoning of, new life and new investment. And it was an exciting time. Denny was there off and on for 3 years living there. I kind of stayed and kept the home fires burning, but we became part of that culture. So, it's just evolved over time.
Is there any other Czech and Slovak history center in the United States?
There is nothing like this. And I have traveled the country on behalf of the museum. There are many small local heritage, places, which are really important to the local communities. But there is no other professionally run, professionally curated, museum and library of the size or the stature of ours.
We're going to take just a short break. Gail Naughton, who's the President and Chief Executive Officer of the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. We'll be back as Talk of Iowa continues in a minute. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Rees talking to Gail Naughton. This is a museum update hour on Talk of Iowa. We're hearing this segment about the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, which, of course, was devastated in the horrendous flood of 2008 and now is moving on to bigger and better, maybe I should say higher things, because, Gail, a new building is planned that will be safe from future floods. And how are things proceeding with that?
Well, we are sure hoping that that's the case. I think I mentioned that we had this signature building, this icon, this iconic building in Cedar Rapids, and it couldn't be what it was designed to be. And so we did two things. We knew we had to build new. And we looked, first of all, about where that should be. We looked all through the Czech neighborhoods, both sides of the river in Cedar Rapids, on the east and west sides. But we kind of came full circle back around to the area where we are right now, and chose that as the site where we would be able to rebuild. Then we started looking at, okay, what can this building be? And we talked about whether it could be, a program center, whether you should lease it, sell it. We considered whether it could be a pavilion, opened up and be like a park pavilion. And of course, you know, demolition is always, you know, is always on the table. But we came around to the decision to actually lift it and move it. We've met with firms about this, engineers. It can be done. They swear. In fact, they can lift it, move it, and set it down within an eighth of an inch of where we want it to be.
And, I'm thinking that the University of Iowa in 1904 moved Calvin Hall across the street with horses and other amazing.
And now they do it with a little joystick. You know, they set it all up and it's all electronic. And what this, you know, this will do many things. It will move this building from flooding because we are going to not only move it, but we're going to lift it up higher. And we're going to lift it. There was 8 feet of water in the building, and the Corps of Engineers recommends that we go 3 feet above that. Mm. So our intention is that the floor of the museum itself will be 11 feet or 3 feet higher, 3 feet higher than the flood of 2008. So we're going to move it over, lift it up, and we will put a layer of parking underneath. And parking is always desirable, and so that will give us the height we need. And so it's going to be quite prominent. It was prominent before, but it will be very now.
Yeah, the red roof.
The red roof will tower.
Red being the color, right?
Yes, it is. It is. And it stands out. And you know, it's just a win-win. It's just a win-win. We're going to be able to save the building, incorporate it into, you know, a new, larger building. And should be pretty exciting.
Will this be an improvement in your exhibition areas? Is it going to be better quality space than you had?
Well, you know, one of the other complicating factors for us is that literally 3 days after the flood occurred, we were going to have an announcement of an expansion. We had spent the previous 6 months designing an expansion to the existing museum because we'd outgrown our space. Our attendance had grown. Our collections had grown. Our endowment was growing. We were financially, you know, sound, and we were preparing to expand. So when all this happened, you know, we couldn't just rebuild that building. It wasn't big enough, and the needs don't change, you know. So we knew it had to be larger. So, yes, we will have a larger permanent exhibition, and we will have an additional galleries for changing exhibits. Mm-hmm. We will have collection storage, and that will be larger than we had before. We will have a wonderful research library. We were woefully underspaced, if you will, for the library prior to the flood, and this will be a great opportunity to, you know, establish it as it should be.
Was there a debate about where to put the new museum? It just seems inconceivable that anybody would want to locate it on the outskirts of town. You know, in new areas where the Czechs and the Slovaks and settled, you know, where they are now.
Yeah.
And
there was never really much doubt. We knew we needed to stay in the Czech Village, New Bohemia area. That's the heart of the city. It's the heart of where your major attractions need to be. It's the heart of the ethnic area where we belong. The people who founded the museum, this is their area. We really, in the very, very early days, recommitted to being part of Czech Village. And they need us, and we need them. It works both ways. They're part of, you know, and we're going to be incorporating that even more so into our visitor experience now.
You know? And you have, for example, someone who's going to be focusing on oral history.
That's a nice story.
And it sounds like this oral history project coordinator will be working not just in Cedar Rapids, but elsewhere.
Yeah, we had written a grant prior to the flood to the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which is a federal agency in Washington, D.C., to do a national oral history project. And we got a phone call in July after the flood of June saying, you know, congratulations, you received this wonderful national grant. And we, you know, we didn't even have computers that worked hardly. And we were just, you know, we were thrilled because it really is work that a national museum should do. We delayed the start of the project a little bit, but this woman is funded by that grant, and she will be working in Chicago, Cleveland, and Washington, D.C. We're very excited.
Yeah.
We do have visitors from all over the country, and people have made their way. Either they didn't even know a flood occurred or they thought we'd be open by now and, you know, have made their way to Czech Village looking for us. And we really want to reinvigorate that national visitorship and get them back to eastern Iowa and back to the state, you know, we are, you know.
Do you have genealogy research? Is that
yes,
a
we do. We do, and we plan to increase that. That was one of the plans for the new library when we had more space, was to significantly increase our genealogical resources. So we have some, but we plan to do more there because it really is quite a growing pastime, if you will.
So you have documents and books and so forth that are not available online, for example.
Right. There are a lot of all the things that family histories and family and city and town stories of towns. And so if the different kinds of unique resources that genealogists look for. Another interesting tidbit from the flood, prior to the flood, we had been working on national accreditation for our museum. This is from the American Association of Museums, and about 5% of museums in the United States are accredited. And it takes about 3 years. This is a long process, a lot of reporting and peer review and so forth. And we had gone through that whole process. And the last thing to do was for the peer review report to be kind of accepted and approved by the Accreditation Commission. And that was to happen in July after the flood happened in June. And they tabled our application. They said, we don't know what to do. We've got a museum that's trying to be accredited, and everything we're accrediting has been, you know, been damaged. And I wrote them a long letter, and I said, you know, one of the things about being accredited is you respond to a disaster the best you can. You do the best practices. You know, we were working with conservators within hours and so forth. And so within about another month or two after they had another meeting, we were approved for national accreditation. A museum with no walls collections stored in numerous locations at the moment. But that was a real boost of confidence for us that we were coming back and doing things the right way.
That's fantastic.
A disaster can happen to anybody, anytime.
Absolutely.
You know, so
absolutely.
So it's just another little piece.
And so, are you fundraising now then for the new building?
Yes, we are. We were very fortunate in the iJobs bill that was passed by the legislature and the governor last session to receive an allocation for $10 million. That gave us the money that we needed to get started on building the new exhibition center and research library. So now we're fundraising to raise the balance that we need. We are still looking at about a $25 million total recovery for all the pieces that have to go together. But we have a lot of support locally and nationally, too.
Sure.
And the Czech government was the first gift we received. So
they've not lost faith in you.
No, they haven't. They are our great, great friends, and it's wonderful.
Gail Naughton, thank you so much. I wish you well with your fundraising, with the new building, and everything you're doing. It's excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gail Naughton is president and chief executive officer of the National Czech and Slovak Museum in Cedar Rapids. Talk of Iowa continues in 5 minutes with an update on activities at the Figge Art Museum in Davenport. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese. Our Iowa Museum update continues. A look at the Figge Art Museum in Davenport. I talked to Museum Executive Director Sean O'Hara. Sean, more than 65,000 visitors came to the Figge Museum in 2009, a 10% increase from the previous year. Congratulations, first of all. That's great news.
Thank you.
What's your explanation? Is a lot of people would say it's the University of Iowa collection that's now there, but are there other reasons too?
Well, it's a mixture of things. I think the University of Iowa collection is certainly part of it. It's an important collection, and it's gotten a lot of press, and it deserves a lot of press. And I think also the recession has something to do with it. I suspect that people are staying in their own region. They're not traveling to Las Vegas or Florida like they used to, I suppose. And gas prices had a certain effect on it as well. So there are a lot of reasons. We're doing quite a few things here in addition to the University of Iowa. We have many more programs, and now we have the John Deere collection coming to the museum, so that's given us press. And I think as people learn more about the museum, they're more likely to come. You know, the museum was originally the Davenport Museum of Art, mm-hmm. and when it changed its name and moved locations, I think it was in some way starting over again. And so it takes a little while for people to come up to speed with what's being offered in their community.
In a spectacular new building, of course.
Yes, absolutely right. And I also like to add that not only is it a first-rate building and probably one of the finest in the world, which is good for Iowa, but also it was incredibly cheap, no matter what people say. If you compare the building to other building projects in the region, like the new addition to the RSU Chicago, you'll see that we are perhaps one-fifth, if not less, of the cost than it is to do something like that.
Just maybe a little cheaper to build in Davenport, Iowa. Is that the reason?
It is. I think Iowa is better priced in general for a lot of things.
Well, a lot of people are probably thinking, well, you have the Pollock, of course, referring to Jackson Pollock's mural.
That's right.
An incredible piece of art, priceless. Are people
incredibly important work?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do people actually walk in the door just to see the Pollock?
Well, people do remark on it. We've had some high-profile visitors come to see the Pollock. The new director of the Hirshhorn paid a visit several months ago, and we've had press come to see the Pollock. I think it's a draw. Some people have told me it's worth the entire visit, but I'm sure that the Iowa collection in general is a draw. I think there are so many other exhibitions going on, I suspect that the Pollock is part of it, but not the entire story.
Now, the Pollock is worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. Nobody really knows for sure, but have you had to increase security because of that piece?
Yes, we're aware of the notoriety, and really for the entire collection, of course we have incredibly high tech security systems. So we have many cameras and many ways of doing security that aren't obvious to people. Mm. We have increased our presence there just because people. Although people know that they shouldn't touch art,
yeah.
People will often try to do something like that. So we're always there to remind them. We have put stanchions up, and I think that's trained people to stand further away from paintings.
There's some confusion about how much of the University of Iowa collection you have at the Figge. I've heard it. I mean, people have said maybe what you have 95%. Is that what? How
right.
much?
That's right. There are a few hundred items in Iowa City at the which is a limited viewing, and that's probably, and I don't know the exact figure, several hundred pieces. But the University of Iowa has over 12,000 works of art, and we here in the Figge Art Museum are only able to display, you know, up to 100 items. Even though we're quite a large museum, a lot of the important pieces of the University of Iowa collection are very large. So that means that there are, you know, close to 11,000 plus objects in storage right now.
Now, are they in storage at the Figge?
Yes.
Okay. So there's no longer, you know, University of Iowa pieces stored in some warehouse in Chicago or
no,
wherever they...
It was a priority for a lot of people to move the state of Iowa's art collection, which is what it is, to the state of Iowa. And it is now all in the state of Iowa, except that there were some pieces being restored, and that's sort of natural. So they're restored outside the state sometimes. And also, for insurance reasons, it has to be held in the highest quality museum-grade storage space. Mm. And it just so happens that we have one of the newest art museums in the country and one of the highest-grade facilities, and so it was perfect to store the items which in a location which is only about an hour away from the main site in Iowa City.
How long will you keep the University of Iowa collection there until the university puts up a new building for their museum?
Pretty much. It will depend on the university's plans and how quickly they can implement them. But that will involve planning, fundraising, and building. I can give you an idea. When we started building the building here in Davenport, it took us between 3.5 to 4.5 years to construct the building and to get it all finished and launch it. And that, of course, was when financing was readily available. So in many ways, your guess is as good as mine in terms of the length of time. But it'll be a few years at least.
Yeah. Well, you've got a big facility. I mean, it's certainly bigger than the University of Iowa Museum of Art was.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, that's right. And when we first built it, there was criticism that perhaps it was too large. I would say that in hindsight, and of course a lot of it had to do with luck, the fact that the University of Iowa's museum was obliterated by the Iowa River, I think probably gave this facility new purpose because not many states or regions have spare museum facilities within an hour of a major disaster like what happened in Iowa City.
As you said, about 60 miles down the road. That is pretty amazing, isn't it?
It is. It's your luck. I would also like to say that the state of Iowa did contribute significantly to this museum building here in Davenport through the Vision Iowa plan, and I think that that was in many ways incredibly good of them to have this facility built, because now we're able to do what we do for the state of Iowa's collection and for the university.
Is this a unique situation? Have you ever heard of another situation where a major university collection ends up stored at a different museum for such a long period of time?
No, I often say to people that you only see these sort of situations in times of war.
Yeah.
And although it wasn't a war, very few museums get wiped out like Iowa City's museum did. So I think that it's pretty unique. The director of the Hirshhorn, when he showed up, mentioned that he had never seen this before. He also wanted to add that he was very happy to see two museums work together for a common purpose, because he says in many cases museums never work together very well, as do many institutions never really work very well. So he was very happy to see this arrangement.
Do you have University of Iowa Museum staff working in the building?
On and off. They have spaces that they curate within this building. We felt that it was important for both the collection, for the public, and for the staff that the University of Iowa Museum of Art had a home that they could call their own. And so they have space here which they curate, and when they're not curating it, when they're not doing things in space, they're not here. So I would say on average we'll have University of Iowa Museum staff here once or twice a week.
Yeah. Has the university collection displaced some of your own collections that you had to put aside?
Oh, yes, it had. We've had to move not only exhibition space around, but we had to really rearrange all our backroom space, because we needed to fit 12,000 works of art in just a matter of weeks into the museum. And needless to say, my staff hadn't really planned on doing that last year until just a few weeks before it started.
Well, beside the fact that whether or not it's the University of Iowa collection that is attributable to your increase in visitors. You have your own, as you say, your own collections, and you've also had the economy. We've talked about that, people staying closer mm-hmm. to homes, but you've I know also that you're doing more outreach. Is that due to at least some extent that school systems cutting back on their art programs?
Yes, that has been happening over a number of years, and some of the schools in our area actually don't even offer art to public school students in elementary grades, which I think is quite unbelievable. What we found, though, and I think one of the keys to the success of our outreach program, is that we found that students learn more from pictures in many ways than they do from reading, especially difficult subjects that really need to involve images. And so, for example, we run a very large, if not the largest, program in the area on the Holocaust. And, of course, images play an important part in that. So we're able to use artists' renderings and art to illustrate aspects of the subject and to teach those subjects. So in a way, we're sneaking art in through the back door, but we're using art also for what art is meant for, which is to communicate ideas. And for students, many of them get more out of looking at pictures than they would reading. So it's working well for their exam scores, and take-up is incredibly high. To give you an example, we have one teacher running this program, and that poor teacher is handling close to 10,000 students.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about, given the earthquake in Haiti, you have just a fabulous Haitian art collection. Is this one of the best in the country?
It is. It's also what we think is the first Haitian collection in the public sphere in the United States. We had a rather prominent member of our community, Dr. Walter Neiswanger, start to collect Haitian art on a large scale in the early 1960s. And I think he also had interactions with Waterloo and Milwaukee. So I think their collections are also connected to Mr. Neiswanger. Mm-hmm. And we started collecting in the early 60s here at the museum, and we've built a collection of about 200 works. We're not the largest now in the country, but we definitely have some of the most important works in Haitian art, especially for the 20th century.
What is unique about Haitian art?
Well, Haitian art stands out in the Caribbean in the same way that Haiti stands out in the Caribbean. The background in history is quite different. Haiti was, as many of you know, the first independent country, if I can put it that way, in the Caribbean. The first country to throw off the yoke of colonialism. It was a country that rose out of a revolution, a slave revolution. And the art encompasses a lot of the religious aspects from Africa in the form of voodoo and other worship other religions, and also Catholicism is heavily involved. So you get art that is colorful and full of cultural references and religious references, which are specific to Haitian society.
I bet kids love it because it's so colorful and interesting, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's very popular with the public and with children in particular because of the colors, because the stories they tell. They almost always invariably involve animals or people, and they're always telling a story, and people like that. You don't find a lot of abstract art, for example, in Haitian art, at least in our collection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, you have some very interesting some new developments at the Figge, including you're going to be showing works from the John Deere collection.
That's right.
Which had been stored someplace in the Quad Cities. I'm sure they don't have room for to display all of the pieces that they have at the company headquarters. So, describe a little bit more about how you're proceeding with this.
Well, we have been discussing various ways of bringing the public into contact with parts of the John Deere collection, which in some areas is quite significant. And it got to a point where the executives at John Deere realized that this collection is important and that the public would benefit greatly if John Deere could open up access to the collection. They realized that, of course, with their corporate setup, security is an issue, but using a public art museum like the Figge Art Museum would be a perfect solution to that. And so for at least the couple hundred of their items that are museum grade, we will be opening a gallery in our permanent collection, and we will be displaying the best from that collection, from John Deere's collection, on an ongoing basis, and it'll rotate to keep things fresh. We will also do our best to tour parts of the collection around the region and the country and also abroad.
I always find it interesting that some corporations have managed to have these incredible art collections. I mean, why did Deere and Company start collecting art? Was it a number of executives in past decades that started this for investment purposes, or why?
No, I think it wasn't for investment purposes, from what I understand, not like other collections like Bank of America and Deutsche Bank, for example, I believe. The driving force for the John Deere collection was Bill Hewitt, who had been the head of John Deere for many years, and his wife. They loved Japan, and they collected a lot of Japanese art. They collected art from all the areas that John Deere did business, and they built a new headquarters in the 1960s with Eero Saarinen, who was a Finnish architect, and they decided to purchase more art for that new facility. So in the collection, you will see very significant representation by Japanese artists of the 50s and 60s, South American artists, abstract expression artists even, from parts of South America, Mexican artists, and of course, what they're also famous for are regionalist artists. Grant Wood is well represented in the John Deere collection.
And you say that fall plowing, which you say is the second most famous Grant Wood painting.
Yes, probably. Yes, that's right.
Okay. I mean, who has determined that it's number two?
Right. So. But it's definitely in the top several, and we have the painting in the galleries now because we felt that it was important at least to give people a preview of John Deere's most significant work of art. We also own the oil sketch for that painting, so we will be showing the two together soon. And we are also involved in a new discovery, which is a pencil sketch for the same work.
Wow. Yeah.
So for the first time, we might be able to unite all these versions by Grant Wood.
Where did you find the pencil sketch?
Well, the pencil sketch was offered to Deere & Company by a dealer outside the state. And when it looked like we were going to be displaying fall plowing, we were asked if we wanted to consider this, and one of our supporters is involved now in seeing what can be done.
And last but not least, you have another University of Iowa collection coming, The Footsteps of Masters, The Evolution of the Reproductive Print.
That's right.
And describe that in the minute we have left here.
Sure. That is a really fantastic exhibition. It's difficult to explain to people that the several hundred years of printmaking in Europe can be really interesting, but the exhibition shows the evolution of that all the way from Albrecht Dürer and printmaking in Germany in the late 15th century all the way to Grant Wood and printmaking in America in the 20th century. It is incredibly varied. It is incredibly colorful for a relatively black and white exhibition, and it is a first-rate exhibition, both academically and artistically.
Sean O'Hara, Executive Director of the Figge Art Museum in Davenport. Thanks a lot. I wish you well with all these collections. Sounds like things are booming at the Figge.
Thank you very much. Tell everyone to come.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sean O'Hara is the Executive Director of the Figge Art Museum in Davenport. That's Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.